You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. Go Wild is a free social community created for and by hunters. This means that unlike mainstream social media, your trophy pictures won't be censored. They're encouraged. As you spend time on Go Wild, you will earn awesome rewards such as gift cards, free swag, and big discounts on brands like Garmin and Vortex. You will even earn $10 just for signing up. Visit downloadgowild.com and sign up today. New from Moultrie Mobile, the Feed Hub offers first-of-its-kind cellular connection and control for nearly any spin cast feeder on the market. When used with the Moultrie Mobile app, you can monitor feed and battery levels, run feeders on demand, receive alerts when feeders are clogged, and remotely adjust feeding times. The Feed Hub is ideal for anyone who maintains feeders. Remove the guesswork and save time by planning feeder maintenance before you drive to your hunting property. For more information, visit MoultrieMobile.com.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today we're going to be talking with Bill Thompson of Spartan Forge. Now, if you're not familiar with Spartan Forge, it is a mobile hunting app that you can download to your phone. They also have desktop availability. But, man, we talk a lot about technology today. We talk about algorithms. We talk about collared deer studies. We talk about 3D map imagery. And just like, it's crazy where hunting technology has gone in the last several years. Because I can remember before cell phones, before internet, before even trail cameras were out, I would just go into the woods and hunt. And now it seems like if you're not taking some type of some device with you that has, that I would use the word technology, that is technology, like a digital technology, like a computer program or something like that, then you're lost, right? I use Hunt Stand right now, and I just imagine what you take those mobile apps away from me and having to go back to the old printed maps or the old plat books and what that would be like, and or like it would be absolutely crazy. And so the industry has changed. The technology has changed. And some say it's for the better. Some people don't like it. But today we get into a really detailed conversation with Bill about Spartan Forge, how he kind of came up with some of the stuff that he's come up with, the advancements that the app has made over the last couple years, how all of that all the data that he collects translates into information given to the end user on what days hunt. If you're not familiar with Spartan Forge, it is a predictive deer hunting, a predictive deer movement platform that tells you basically in your area what days are going to be the best to hunt, given, you know, collared deer study data, given weather, how weather impacts deer movement, historical data like that. And so it's a really interesting episode, and I'm sure if you guys are deer nuts, you know, this isn't 100% gear talk, because we also get into things like what drives certain aspects like humidity and precipitation and how that affects deer in different parts of the country. So it's a fun episode. I always like talking with guys like Bill who are extremely intelligent. And even at the beginning of the episode, we get a little background into Bill and his time spent in the military doing whatever it is he was doing in the military. So it's a pretty interesting episode. I know you guys will like it. Before we get into today's episode, though, I do have to send a shout out to the people who make this podcast possible. If you guys are looking for a saddle, and I know that this year I'm going to be taking a couple more, what I would say, less spot and stock, more tree stand hunts. And so I'm getting ready and I'm excited to use a saddle more this year. So if you're looking for a saddle, saddle hunting accessories, platforms, climbing sticks, you name it, go check out Tethered. If you are looking to document your hunts, then I strongly suggest you go check out Tacticam. The Tacticam has the new 6.0 version currently out. It has image stabilization. It has an LCD screen. It records in 4K. It can be mounted to your bow. It can be mounted to your gun. And that way you can record what you see out in the woods. And then you can come home, show the wife, show the kids, show your buddies. Even helps with shot placement. If you're unsure about where you shot a deer, let's say, you can take it home, throw it in your computer, review the footage, and then that'll tell you if you need to wait or go after the deer. So Hunt Stand is the next one. Let's see, Tacticam and then Hunt Stand. If you're looking for, you know, today we talk a lot about mobile apps. So if you are looking for a mobile hunting app, if you're a hardcore deer hunter, go check out Hunt Stand. Hunt Stand has a lot of functionality behind it. Hunt Stand is one of the most popular apps on the market for a reason, and it's just because it gives you a lot of options. And while you're at huntstand.com, read up on all that functionality, and then also read up on their Pro Whitetail platform that they've just introduced over the last year. It's pretty intriguing. So go check that out, huntstand.com. And that's it. The other thing I want to say real quick is we do a lot of talking about gear on this podcast, very little talk about conservation. So if you are looking to give back in 2023, I'm not going to sit here and try to pitch it. Go look at fishandwildlife.org in the conservation organization, 2% for conservation. Go check that out, see what they're all about. And if you want to get 2% for conservation certified, go check that website out. So we're done with the intro. Let's just get into today's episode with Bill Thompson of Thompson or Thomas. Oh, I messed it up. Either way, I apologize. Bill from Spartan Forge. All right, from Spartan Forge, I have Bill Thompson on the show today. Bill, what's up, man?
Not much, Dan. How are you?
Doing good. Hey, remind me again where you're located.
Right now I'm out in West Virginia in Bridgeport. I retired from the military last year in November, and my wife got a job out here. So we've been out here in West Virginia. I can kind of work from anywhere, but I suppose it's been a couple years since I've been going back and forth from out here. But yeah. In West Virginia now.
Gotcha. And so let's see, how many years in the military, and what was your kind of background in the military?
Yeah, so I did almost 21 years. My background in the military is complex, but I started as an enlisted guy doing like signals intelligence, which is, you know, just think like radios, cell phones, that type of stuff, signals intelligence, exploitation. And radars as well. And then I kind of pivoted from there to going into the human intelligence realm, which is like, you know, sources and that type of stuff, well deployed and doing that type of work. But from a technical point of view, I became a warrant officer about 11 years ago. And the easiest way to think about a warrant officer is like a technician in the military, just kind of advising general officers and colonels on what types of technologies are good, which ones are not good, how they can be integrated into the unit to be like a force multiplier for a commander while they're, you know, overseas or doing their mission in garrison or whatever. And the kind of warrant officers kind of sit in between. We're not soldiers. We're soldiers, but we're not enlisted men. And we're also not officers. We're kind of like in between. So if you think about the military as like a school, your NCOs are kind of like your teachers, whereas your lower enlisted guys are kind of your students. And then you have your officers, which are like your principals, your vice principals, administrators, that type of thing. Warrant officers would be the guys who are like recommending the curriculum and what books to use and what, you know, that type of thing. They're the technical experts of a military unit.
Okay, I gotcha. And so in order for you to recommend those things, you have to be somewhat well-versed in those things. So what kind of training did you guys have to go through? I mean, is it like drone training, or is it more like, hey, here are a list of educational tactics that you can use to train your soldiers better?
So for myself, the training that I went through was a lot of technical, well, there's technical and tactical training, but a lot of it was computer programming, network diagnostics, understanding what networks are, what their vulnerabilities are, how they work. And then there were other disciplines too, where I learned other, how to go and meet a guy for a meeting and, you know, in the middle of maybe, you know, in Pakistan somewhere, and
yeah,
arrange a meeting where there's operational security and there's, you know, your physical security, and you're thinking about all of the second and third order effects of those things. But I was, again, looking at those types of things from a technical perspective. So the training was vast. There was lots of different, you know, we could do a whole podcast on just the training and all of the stuff that goes into that, from the technical side to the operational side and the tactical side and all of that. But there was a lot of it there. And I guess if I had to summarize it all, it would be, lots of learning, you know, coding, code bases, network architecture, and then kind of the tactical implementation of the exploitation of those types of networks and so on and so forth.
So, you know, everybody talks about how big the United States military budget is, right? And we have the biggest, baddest military in the world for a reason. It's because we spend a lot of money on it. And so were you able to get your hands on some pretty, like, I don't know, whether that's maybe software or just things like that are just like, holy cow, this is mind-blowingly awesome?
Yeah, so I'll say this about my experience of the U.S. government. Doing on that side of the house, some of the stuff I did, you could consider it like ethical hacking.
Yeah.
And I think my last year, I was an advisor for a general officer and for a colonel that were doing development in what was called the offensive cyber realm. So that's ethical hacking. I believe that year the U.S. budget for the DOD was something like $750 billion. And I would say that 60% of that budget is judiciously executed, whereas the other 40% is wasted.
Yeah.
There's some reason it's necessary for waste sometimes, but a lot of times it's just the government is very resistant to updating and resistant to kind of cutting the fat. but so there are cool programs that I worked on and there are cool things that I built. But at the end of the day, it was the ability for me to do the kind of stuff that would be illegal in any other context.
I gotcha.
So whether that's breaking systems, breaking networks, let your mind wander, all of the things that you would want to do if you had, you know, a free rein to break as much as you wanted to. And that's kind of the role of the military, is not to get too deep into it, but they have what's called, you know, Title 10 authority.
Yeah.
And Title 10 authority just means you get to break shit.
Yeah.
And as long as it achieves the goals. So yes, there were cool tools and there were cool things that we got to use, but at the end of the day, it was more about the tactics and the operations that we got to engage in that I think really separates us from everyone else. Because anybody else who was doing the things that I was doing for my last 10 years of my military career would have been arrested in any other context.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that was the best part.
That's absolutely crazy. Now, I've talked to some guys before who I don't know if I would say they were directly in the same type of platform that you were in or doing exactly what you were doing, but they did some pretty cool things. Where was the balance between like stress and dude, this is awesome doing this type, like fun?
Yeah. So the stress was more on like the family side.
Yeah.
Or not being around my kids when they were young. You know, I missed the birth of my son, deploying to Iraq, I think for my second tour to Iraq. This for me, at least, I feel like I'm an outlier in the military because I just benefited tremendously from my military service in a way that I think is exceptional, and really a story that's only possible in the U.S. So, I joined from a trailer home in the middle of nowhere, North Dakota, where I really had no prospects for my future, and, you know, got into the military and kind of lucked into some things, which is, again, a whole nother podcast that I could do. About, you know, one of the reasons I got into intelligence work is just because I simply forgot my driver's license at home. So I was signing up to be an MP because I was 16, maybe 17 at the time when I was signing up. And I wanted to be a military policeman, and I just simply forgot my driver's license. And I was like, the recruiter's like, well, you can come back next month, because we had to go to Minneapolis from where I was from in North Dakota in order to sign up. And I was like, look, I'm not going home for another month. Sign me up for something else and get me the hell out of here. And so to kind of answer your question, my military service, I just benefited tremendously. I came out with degrees. I came out with certifications. I came out speaking three languages. I came out with a wealth of knowledge. And it's kind of one of the reasons why I pushed so hard. You know, when I started the company and I was bringing employees on, I was like, look, everything that we're going to do, we're going to try to benefit military people in one way, or, you know, we could talk about it later, but we do these veterans hunts and that type of thing where we're raising money for people that didn't benefit from my military service. So for me, most of the suck involved in the military was being away from my kids, being away from family, missing things like death of grandparents and, yeah, you know, the type of stuff that you would want to be around for. But on the other hand, you know, I could fill a whole podcast with what I thought were all the awesome things I got to do, yeah, in the military, breaking things, you know, coming up with cool technology to assist the Special Operations Command, getting latitude to do all of the kind of like cool stuff that you think. For the first 5 or 7 years, I really didn't get to do a lot of cool stuff. It was a lot of motor pools. It was a lot of checking vehicles. It was being a grunt. It was rucksacking around and carrying stuff and PMCSing vehicles, preventative maintenance and checks on vehicles, and kind of just being a grunt. And then I kind of fell into getting to do other stuff later, after I guess I'd kind of proved myself, where I did get to do the stuff that I think most people dream about whenever they, you know, a lot of guys when they join the intelligence discipline in the military dream about the stuff that I did for like the last 13 years. And again, just super beneficial. Yeah. And super fortunate to get all of that. So that's kind of what it was to me. You know, I didn't mind deploying. I didn't mind doing operations. I lived for doing operations. I lived for supporting the battlefield commander. I lived for doing, you know, technical assistance for human intelligence operations, for signals intelligence operations. I used to fly around in airplanes and set up operations for ODA teams and special forces guys to go in and do stuff. Like, really got to get all of the benefits from it. And really, yeah, the problem for me was just being away from my kids, but I'm making up for that now. So
there you go. There's always time. There's always time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, 21 years in the military, you step away from it. You're retired now. Now, how many years ago did you start Spartan Forge?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I actually started Spartan Forge while I was deployed to Afghanistan in 2015. So I was still active duty. I didn't incorporate, you know, I incorporated the business in 2017. The first name I had come up for Spartan Forge was called Open Season. And I started collecting collared GPS data and dealing with academics and talking to people through my experience. I was working At the time, I had just gotten done advising on a development effort with DARPA, which is kind of like the mad scientists of the DoD. They just get to think up all kinds of crazy stuff, like, hey, you know, let's put a rocket on Mars. They do that type of stuff. And so I was working with them, and I'd met some academics and made some inroads to people, and I had built or assisted and supervised the building of other neural networks to benefit the government and the military. And it started occurring to me that I could probably do a lot of this stuff with GPS data from collared deer studies. So I started collecting that. I made my first phone calls to academics and talking to people just during downtime while I was in Afghanistan in 2015, between operations. I would, you know, just reach out and say, hey, I'm here doing this type of stuff, and I think I could do the same thing. And a lot of academics were willing to share that data, and that's kind of when I started doing that. And I've been collecting it ever since. I just got some more deer data the other day that we're working on integrating to our neural network. So pretty continuous since 2015.
Yeah. And so when you first started Spartan Forge, did or the company or what, you know, that you had before Spartan Forge, before the name tag, was it always about forecasting deer movement, or had you planned into going into the high debt, the high definition, very detailed mapping and all the other stuff that comes with Spartan Forge?
Yeah. So no, I wanted to focus on neural networks. I always saw Spartan Forge as a machine learning company. There are other things I want to do, and I still am doing in my very little spare time, in the neural network, machine learning, artificial intelligence realm that I do. And I always wanted to start the company as a machine learning company. I still call it a machine learning company. I was originally supposed to be working. I'd worked for about 2 years with another very prominent mapping company, the most prominent mapping company, had basically gotten to the point where I was going to sign a contract with them. But then, you know, things came up for me, and I didn't, you know, the contract wasn't favorable because it kind of locked me down for many years. And I always thought, I want to focus on the machine learning side of stuff. I just need to integrate with an application that's already doing this, and then I can help them do it better, because a lot of these companies that are out there are just dealing in commodity data. It's just, you know, you can think of them as like, you know, British Petroleum, Amco, and another oil company. Like, all three of them are just selling oil. They're not doing anything crazy or innovative with the oil. Mapping data is out there. None of these companies that launch these programs are collecting their own mapping data. They're paying other companies to go and do it, or to get the information. So my focus was always, what do we do with this mapping data, or how do we improve the lot of hunters by capitalizing on this data and then integrating it with other pieces of data that and creating a comprehensive planning and execution picture for hunters, a lot like I did with the military. A lot of the programs I advised on the military were multi-intelligence, multi-source intelligence collection systems that presented information to commanders in what's called like a common operating picture. This common operating picture is kind of like, from a military perspective, it's kind of like a snapshot of what the battlefield looks like and all of the amplifying information that's collected and updated, so the commander can look at it at any time and have a pretty good picture of what's going on in their area of responsibility. My goal with anything I was going to do in Spartan Forge was to integrate with another company, and then kind of show them what else was the art of possible and put it all together in this, you know, common operating picture. And Spartan Forge itself now is moving towards that. I'd say we're about 40 or 50% of the way there. My goal was to integrate with someone else, but once I did a lot of investigation on some of these other companies, and I don't want to speak out of school on here. I encourage people to do their own look into these companies, but I didn't like some of the investors that they had. I didn't like the core tenets or principles of the investors that they had, or the leadership that they had, whether it was because they were anti-First Amendment or anti-Second Amendment, or the investors in some of these companies. But I always said to myself, I'll still join with these companies because I don't want to do this all on my own. But then the contracts were just so litigious and so that, you know, they want to do a year-long contract with you, then lock you down for not doing anything else with anyone else for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't willing to do that. So then I basically was on the call one day with a guy who was in charge of one of these companies. He was the president, I believe. And he just kept telling me, like, look, just come with us, do the neural network stuff. Let us worry about mapping. You don't want to worry about mapping. Mapping's really difficult. And he said that like 3 times to me on the call. And by the end of the call, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do mapping. Anybody who says it's that difficult that much must be lying.
Yeah.
So I went and looked into it and I was like, this isn't difficult at all. The difficult part's the machine learning part. So that kind of led me to where I am today.
Yeah. All right. So you've used terms like machine learning and neural network. Yes.
Yeah.
So for a dumb old deer hunter like myself, explain what that is.
The simplest way to think of a neural network is that it's a computer system that recognizes patterns in data and then can make predictions on those patterns.
Gotcha.
So the reason it's called a neural network is because it's inspired by the structure and the function of the human brain. So in a neural network, there's like layers of neurons, and each one of those neurons become weighted based on the data that you show it. So the simplest way to think about this is, you know, and I'm going to kind of jack this up, but I'm trying to make the analogy work. If you have like 3 ways that you travel to work, from your home to work, if you have like 3 routes that you take, you can think about that like a neuron, like a structure, and say over the last year, your time in the car is measured every time you drive a certain route or a different route. You could have a machine look at that and say, well, over the past year, what was the most efficient route when it was raining? What was the most efficient route when it was sunny? What was the most efficient route during this time because there was traffic, or this time when there wasn't traffic? And then that neuron gets weighted. And then in the future, you can look at all of those conditions and then make an informed prediction on what route you should take to work based on past circumstances. So a neural network is just millions and millions and millions of those neurons informing a decision based on patterns. And it's the same way that like the human brain works. The human brain, we're just really sophisticated pattern recognition machines. We recognize colors like RGB, and we recognize personalities, and we recognize patterns of other animals and our environment and what things look like. And those patterns comprises the structure of the brain. So in neural networks, you are just making new neurons based on other data. So in this case, the first network that I made was based on caller GPS data to inform those neurons. So during the training, the neural network's given a set of input and corresponding desired outputs, you ask it for what you're getting from it, and then you can measure it and its success based on other data sets. So say I get a bunch of collar deer data from Ohio deer, and I make a neural network for Ohio, I've made it for other states, and then I'll get data from somewhere else, and then I'll wait and see how similar those deer move or how dissimilar those deer are and how they move, and then I'll make another network based on the new data. But I can test the old networks based on the new data. So I hope I explained that well, because it's kind of difficult.
Would this be an accurate statement? Basically what you have is just a ton of data, and you're organizing it in a way that people can see it and find patterns in it.
Yes, exactly. Well, okay. The machines recognize the patterns, and then they try to prescribe the patterns to people.
Gotcha.
The most difficult part of any neural network is the data collection.
Yeah.
Having enough data to do it. Like, I could teach you how to make a convolutional neural network in an afternoon. The algorithms have been around for a long time. It doesn't take a ton of coding experience to actually do this part. Google's made a lot of it very easy through a program called TensorFlow. So you can do it on your own. The difficult part is getting the requisite amount of data to train it.
Gotcha. All right. So when we first talked, you know, as a deer hunter, I live in Iowa, and just for conversation purposes, you just mentioned Ohio, right? And so I live in Iowa. How does deer movement in Ohio or any other state, like, what does that have to do with me here in Iowa? And how can I look at that data from different states and go, hey, you know, and this is talking about predictive deer movement at this point, but why does deer movement in Ohio matter to me in Iowa?
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Sure. So there's a few ways to answer that question. The first way to answer that question is they all are all the same species. So when you have the same species, there are evolutionary underpinnings that kind of are in every animal that are the same, at least from birth. And the only way that you can get rid of them or change them is through a very harsh conditioning. You can think about it like what does Dan Johnson have in common with a guy from Africa? Well, if I throw a baseball at either of them, even if the other guy's never seen a baseball, they will generally flinch and throw their hands in their face as the first reaction. And that comes from like a very deep part of the lizard brain that every human has. So reactions to stimulus are going to be the same across a species, regardless of where the species lives. So with deer in the same way, the reaction to weather events, to what weather events and how it influences deer and deer movement, or the responses to things like drought or different types of factors are going to be the same at some level, or at least we know it's going to influence the animal at some level in the same, but the difference has to become, and the reason why a neural network's important to use in this is because the neural network can look at 50 pieces of input data and say, well, a deer in Iowa and Ohio are pretty similar, but when I'm looking at this from North Carolina, you know, what, you know, the amount of time that adverse weather affects deer in North Carolina versus Ohio are not the same for different types of the year. So for a 3-day rainstorm is going to affect the deer in North Carolina differently than it would affect the deer from Ohio. But what the neural network knows is that it affects both. So it's just the easiest way to answer that is the predictions differ basically based on where you are latitude and longitude wise in the US, based on stressors in the environment differently, but it affects them all just differently. And that's the proper role of a neural network. You would never be able to get a person to recognize all of those nuances. You'd have to hunt your whole life first just to understand deer in an area accurately. But then to understand deer in different areas accurately in different places and what gets them going or what doesn't get them going or moving or all of those things would be an impossible data task for a human to carry out. So that's the proper way for a neural network to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff and find out what in a weather forecast is actually going to impact deer movement and how.
Okay.
So I hope that kind of answers that question.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, I have no short answers. So I appreciate I apologize to everybody in the area, but you know, this stuff is very there's a lot going on here, and when I answer questions, I'm trying to be as accurate and as data science oriented as possible, but still presenting a palatable product for a podcast.
Yeah.
So I hope I can manage that tension.
Yeah. Okay. And so, you know, positioning off that then, all right, we're still talking about predictive deer movement. How do I, the hunter, use everything that you've just said? I download your app, I start to use it. How do I use it and how do I use it properly?
So there are a variety of different ways to use all of the features in the application, but just focusing on the neural network, you should think about it in general deer movement. You shouldn't think about it in specific. It's not going to help you it'll help you, but it's not something I would use biblically against like a 5, 6, or 7 year old buck. Because the one thing I've learned from looking at all of the GPS data, and I've looked at tons and more deer data than I think probably anyone's ever looked at. I'm not sure I've met somebody who's looked at more individual deer and their movements and what affects them. One thing I can say empirically about it is bucks, just none of them are the same, and all of them are different for different reasons. So when it comes to like using my neural network for a buck, especially a mature one, you're going to have to kind of allow it to try to understand how it influences that deer and when it's correct and when it's not correct, and then try to use it, but more use it for just general deer movement. So if you're just out trying to schwack a doe, or you're just out trying to see deer, or you're taking a kid out with you, or you're trying to correlate movement with deer cameras and other things, then the neural network's super handy. But there will never be a network, and it's why I kind of laugh to myself whenever I see these other predictive networks where it's like, hey, I'm Joe so-and-so hunter. I've developed a neural network for deer that's going to get you the biggest buck no matter where you are in the U.S. It's like none of them are the same, and there's no way anybody, one person, could develop a neural network that's going to help you kill a buck, or that's going to accurately say every deer in the woods is going to stand up at, you know, you look at some of these other apps and it's like, what, you need to be in the woods at 1:45 p.m. today. And so you think about that, and a lot of people get excited and they're like, all right, I'm running into the woods at 1:45. But then you sit and think about the data, the proposition of the data, and it's like, so wait, this thing is saying that every deer in the woods is just going to be moving at 1:45. That's not possible.
Right.
So what the hunter needs to understand with a neural network like mine is that it's got thousands of years of deer data. And what I mean by that is if one deer wears one collar for 8 years, that's 8 years of deer data. If three deer wear three collars for 8 years, that's 24 years of deer data. I've looked at, you know, thousands of years of this deer data. And so the what the network has sussed out from that is you basically have three types of movement that categorize deer movement. And that is during the daylight hours, they're going to be staying in their bedding areas. They may move out to transition areas, or they could be anywhere in their range. And those are kind of the three buckets. Anybody saying that they have a network that predicts any better than that is not being honest with you. And the reason is because after all of this deer data, that's about as good as it gets. So you can think about that as it, the value proposition for a hunter could be, when I'm looking at the neural network's going to tell me generally deer are going to be staying close to bedding during daylight hours today, or they may move out into bedding into staging areas or into a scrape line, or they may be just outside of bedding areas, or it could be they're in what we call full range. And the way that a neural network looks at full range is, if you are driving by a field every day to work where you never see deer, then all of a sudden there are 21 deer in that field. The neural network would call that a full range day. In other words, deer are out there moving much more aggressively than they normally would. And there's a litany of factors that influence that. And that's kind of the best that you can hope to get from what would take, you wouldn't have enough humans observing deer for enough time to get that any more clear on that data. So
right.
That network that we've developed predicts accurately still only at like 66, 67% of the time. So, and I'm very clear about that because I'm not trying to oversell somebody or give somebody snake oil on something, but you're getting 2/3 of the time, you're getting an accurate prediction on what most of the deer population will be doing.
Gotcha.
When it comes down to patterning individual bucks or going after any individual bucks, you might find some, it might inform the neural networks. The neural network might inform you some in saying, hey, generally, whenever it says core area day, my buck's not leaving bedding. Yeah. And so that's something I would tell people to look at a one-on-one instance, because again, I'm not going to sell them snake oil and tell them that this thing's far better than it is. It might not be great marketing, but I can sleep at night.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've talked with just about every predictive deer hunting model, app, whatever you want to say, that's currently out there. And for the most part, there are some commonalities. There are some similarities between yours and some of the other ones that are out there. But, and you kind of there just mentioned the, you know, there's like a handful of things that are really that go into the equation that predicts deer movement. The word algorithm pops up in some of this, and how certain apps pop out what days to go hunting and what times to go hunting and things like that. If I said to you, I have 40 years of hunting experience, and I kind of go in and break down what my hunting experience has been in certain conditions, in certain times of year, and I implement that into my algorithm, does that benefit the output of data at all?
I would say in that area where that person has learned and influenced and been able to control that environment, and set up, you know, they're obviously very, you know, people that make those types of networks probably know a lot about their deer on their property. But again, what moves deer on their property where they've learned or where they've looked at these things is not necessarily what's going to get deer moving in Saskatchewan or upper New York or in Florida, which is why we collect this data from all over the U.S. because the factors that get deer moving in Florida are not the factors. I'll give you an example. In Mississippi, relative humidity and humidity in general bears a factor on deer movement. It has almost no factor on North Dakota deer or Minnesota deer. It doesn't change it doesn't affect one way or the other, really, that I can see in the data on what gets deer moving. Another one
that's
is
interesting.
Rain. Yeah, it's just, it depends on the state that you're in and when I'm looking at the data. But then also, when you start getting into areas, you know, one of the things that affect deer movement the most is rainfall. In Alabama, for instance, I've been saying this for a couple of years now. If there's a light rain, I would be hunting all the time. It seems to really get deer moving down in those areas. And I, you know, I've talked to a lot of academics about this, and I think one of the reasons is because they have flash flood scenarios. And I think it helps the deer, if they're dynamic during rainfall, to make sure that they're not getting washed away or something else. And it may be that they just have an evolutionary mechanism that kind of keeps them moving during the rain, because you never know what's going to happen. Whereas again, that we're in flatter areas or in the Midwest where flooding isn't the problem in a specific area outside of like the Red River Valley, the deer don't react to rain like they do in some place like Alabama. Gotcha. But then again, in a place like the mountain country in the Northeast, PA, North Carolina, the Blue Ridge Mountains and out west, you'll see factors like cloud cover and thermal generation affect deer movement much more. Deer in the Northeast need reliable thermal generation and in order to scent check areas, and they need reliable cloud cover in order to understand how the wind is going to shift or be different as a result of movement, especially in pressured areas. Those things really change how nothing will get a deer moving in Pennsylvania like a drastic wind shift. The drastic wind shift, especially among mature deer, they might not move far, but they will move when wind shifts because they want to be in an area, especially when they're bedding, where they can take advantage of the wind direction and thermal generation and the sun's placement in the sky so that they can smell everything around them. If you have a consistent wind, that's the normalized wind for that year, you're not going to see a lot of daytime deer movement in pre-rut or, you know, mid-October in Pennsylvania, whereas wind direction in really tight agricultural country doesn't affect a ton. The deer don't have to move as far, and they're kind of in their shelter belt or their fence row, and they're not going to walk across that beet field or that soybean field and expose themselves just because the wind has changed. Right. So again, that's kind of what I'm getting at with the neural network is I'm able to take this data from all over the country, and all of those factors I just talked about are fed into these algorithms, and then the network can predict the most accurately based on where it is in the U.S.
Gotcha. All right. And so...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time.
Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You got the predictive deer movement portion of this, right? And it sounds to me like that's just continuous, always learning, always improving model, that there's no end to it. It's just a continuous trying to make everything better. Now, when it comes to mapping, right? And you know, you said the guy said it three times in a row, so you thought, well, he's wrong. I'm gonna do it myself. And so you started working with mapping. And it sounds to me like, from what I understand, getting things like landowner data or satellite imagery and things like that is fairly easy to do. What makes then Spartan Forge's maps stand apart from maybe the other apps that are currently on the market?
Sure. So there's a couple of things there. The first, I think, is just the presentation and the user interface and the user experience. We are trying to allow hunters, you know, we have 5 to 15 centimeter imagery for about 45% of the US. And what that means is, if you have the easiest way to think about it is, if you have a 5 centimeter object on the ground, and you fall into that coverage area, you should be able to see it through our mapping. That's, you know, hundreds of times better than what is currently on the market with like 1 to 3 meter imagery. And we just made a value proposition and investment from the beginning to invest in that type of stuff and work with these companies from the very beginning. Whereas it might be cost prohibitive for a very large company to enter into that agreement, especially up front, because of the amount of user base that they have is really what these companies are interested in. But also, we provide them data services back in other ways that are kind of proprietary. But essentially, we have these relationships with these companies, but then we also present different maps from different times of the year, and we also go historical. So on that data, we can go back 14 years on most of it. Some of it is 10, and then a very small subset of it is 7 years. So you can go back and look at how the landscape has changed over time, again, in that high resolution form factor. But then we present three other data layers that are 1 to 3 meter imagery layers throughout many times of the year. So no matter where you are in the U.S., you're going to have some good maps. And it's not just going to be one map and you get what you get. There's going to be these different types of ones, but then also the way that people can interact with them and set up their maps. And for instance, inside of our app mapping application, if you want to look at, if you want to set your map up so that you have slope angle shading on LiDAR with property over it, you can make that custom map in what we call our Lambda layer. But then if you want to switch right back to an aerial, it's just one swipe of the thumb. Whereas in other applications, it's going to require, you know, between 5 and 7 clicks, and in some instances, 15 clicks. So you're spending a lot of time when you're in the field changing things up and doing things. Whereas in our application, it's a very quick movement. And that really comes from my military background and understanding that from a design perspective, I want people to have to physically interact with the application as little as possible in order to get what they need, so that they can focus on what's around them and not having their nose in the phone the whole time they're in the field.
Right.
So that usability and the way that people interact with maps and set them up. But then also what we're gleaning and learning from the mapping. And for instance, here shortly, we'll have out this 1 meter LiDAR imagery for most of the US. And it's very high quality LiDAR imagery, where you can see, in some instances, you can see cow trails on the ground, or you can see benches on the side of hills where you'd never be able to see it with topo or anything else, to really inform scouting, or, you know, even where there's like a seep on the side of a hill. This is stuff that people generally don't have access to or haven't seen in the past. And we've made a large investment in getting that out there. So again, it's not just the data or the access to data, it's how it's presented and then how we show the hunter that this, you know, benefits them from a targeting and hunting perspective.
Gotcha. All right. So my next question then revolves around the data that you actually collect from the user, that on how they're using it. So let's just compare me and you, for example. You may use an app and you may do all the predictive deer movement and you may check your weather and you may still drop pins and then look at the landowner data and do all that stuff. Whereas I may go into it and use it and just go, hey, I'm only using this just to drop pins and that's it. How do you use that information on to take the next step into like the best usability for the end user, or to change or update the app based off that information?
So we don't take a lot of user data and look at that. So when I'm looking at aggregated data to understand like where I might pay for more updated imagery, because like the imagery that I talked about before is very expensive. So I'll look at user distribution and see where my largest user bases are, and then add imagery for those user bases first. That's the really high quality stuff. I'll still give all of the other, the rest of the United States, all the other imagery repositories. But then I'm also looking at what pieces are being used the most or used the least, and then interacting with the pro staff, the guys that we work with, to understand, hey, you know, I see people aren't using the journal in the application as often as they're using historical imagery, or vice versa, and then try to pull the string on that and understand why. But again, the way that we architected this application is, if you're just the guy that just wants to see where your property lines are and you just want to drop pins, like that's all there and the weather is there and you can just use it in that really simple fashion. But then if people go on like our YouTube and watch some of the videos, which I encourage people to do when they sign up for the application, you can get really deep and really, you know, into the details of the data, where you can understand, you know, what's the predominant wind during the second week of November in Kansas, in this part of Kansas. So you get really deep into it. But we try to build the application so it can be as simple as you need it to be, or it can be as complicated as you need it to be, and you can dive as deep into the data as you need to be. But we're constantly looking at that to see what's being interacted with, what's being used, and then understanding from the user where they want to see improvement. And I think that's another thing that separates us from other companies, is that if you message us on social media or ask a question about deer data or about a feature, or a feature you like or you don't like or whatever, my marketing guys will be the first ones to see it, but then they'll direct it to me and I'll be the ones who are answering those. So I spend almost 2 hours a morning just interacting with users to kind of pull the string on the second order of that data, where people are interacting with me and I'm trying to understand exactly what it is they want to see for the user. Whereas I don't think you see that in a lot of other companies, where, you know, the CEO and the lead architect of the solution is interacting with guys at the tactical level to really understand what they need. So that's just a kind of a cross section of how we do all of that.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So you guys, let's just do this. Why don't you tell us what's new on the app, maybe over the last 6 months, what you guys have introduced, any changes or updates to the app?
Yeah. So we introduced the web app, and that's going to be updated here shortly. I've shied away from doing dates now because there are things that I don't control, like the app store and approval and that type of stuff. So we're trying to release it here very soon, but we've released the web app. You can transfer your points on there from other applications if you want, but then you can also just have a different display to look at the mapping, to look at the areas, to look at, you know, to do all of the planning and stuff. So if you're at work or whatever, and you got a lunch break and you want to hop on and look at the maps, you can do that and drop points, and that syncs up with your application. But then secondly, we've released some slope angle shading, which again, we were very meticulous, and I just encourage people to look at it and kind of like our competitors, the way that we built that and architected it makes it extremely accurate in a way that I don't think other people have thought about. And we've updated our 5 to 15 centimeter imagery. We have, on our custom map layer, we've updated the way that people interact with that and can set up custom maps. And then be able to, as I said before, reference those more simplified maps. So it's like you can either click the maps button or you can swipe through, but there are basically four maps or four layers. There's a topo layer, a LiDAR, a aerial layer, a hybrid layer, and then your custom layer. And you can switch between those very quickly. We have our Intel tab that we're constantly updating that gives you, you know, palatability for forage that deer feed on in the area, the buck to doe ratios for county by county, the state draw odds, the state hunter population, the distribution, popular tracts of land. That's all stuff that we've added in the last year. And then going into this off season, we're adding that LIDAR data that I talked about before, which is for about 65% of the U.S. has 1 meter resolution. We added, we have a functionality called Blue Force Tracker that will also be out this spring, which is essentially, say you and your son are hunting the same land together. You can him and yourself download the Spartan Forge app, and then you click your property, and then you say add a Blue Force Tracker team. You put your son's email in there, and now anytime you're on the property together, you're auto sharing location and you're auto sharing points. And you can do that with other buddies if you're scouting large tracts of public land together, or if you're granting access to somebody else to hunt your property, you can tell them, hey, when you're on the property, I'm going to invite you to this Blue Force Tracker team, so I know when you're in my backyard hunting, so I don't send my kids back there. Yeah. That will be out this spring. And then we've also partnered with Eastman's and their Tag Hub data. It's going to be coming out in the application here very soon, where you'll be able to look at state-by-state draw odds and count down to the county level and understand your likelihood of where and when you can draw a tag. And then we're going to be coming out with some neural networks and algorithms in the future that will help optimize for people that are trying to do tag draws throughout the U.S. And then we're finally trying to put out some of our core wear features. We were trying to get those out late last year, but we just realized some problems with the data that we've been fixing over the spring and the summer. So essentially what that'll be is just new ways to look at topography and things that influence deer movement. It starts with this LIDAR layer that I'm talking about, but then it'll eventually get to the point where you can just highlight a piece of ground and the neural network will recommend places that you should scout. So those things are all coming out here, and we're hoping to have, or no, we will button the product down by probably 15 August. So the application that you have going into the hunting season will be the application that you have throughout the year. You know, we've only been out for a year, so last year we had to do in-season updates, but we're going to stay away from that this year, and to just make sure people have the final product once the season comes. And we've got a couple other tricks up our sleeve for stuff that we're going to get out before now and then, but that's kind of the brunt of the offering. And okay. We're also, you know, at the $39 level right now. We'll probably end up having to raise it $5 or $10 after we put some of these other services that I've talked about out. But for people who sign up now, it's, you know, $39 with a 20% off discount. It's like $32 for the year. But then we also have a free application that gives you free property data and pins. So if you just want to use the free version of the application, you'll get free property data on there. You shouldn't have to pay for that. You've already paid for it when you paid your taxes. So that's in the free app, and you can drop pins in there and use it that way if you want.
Gotcha. Cool, man. And so based off of everything you've said in this interview, it sounds to me like you're trying to make Spartan Forge almost a one-stop shop app for everything.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't want to overwhelm the user by putting too much in there, but essentially, you know, when I was a whitetail hunter, which I don't have time for anymore, I'm hoping to get back to it here one day. But, you know, I would be consulting 4, 5, 6 apps while I was doing my planning. My goal is to put that all into a one-stop shop and put all that data in the same place, and kind of push the technological edge and capacity of what data can do for hunters and put it all in a place that looks nice, is easily usable, and highly customizable.
Awesome. Well, I tell you what, Bill, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with us today and give us an update on Spartan Forge. It sounds like not only are you busy, but you got a good thing going over there. So thanks again, man.
Yeah, thank you for your time, Dan. Have a good one.